You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to the Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek: The Next Generation. And tonight's episode is not Star Trek: The Next Generation. This is actually one of the movies, Star Trek V. The Final Frontier, or as I like to call it, Star Trek V, The Search for God. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
James from London, how have you been, bud?
Oh, good, good. I mean, I don't know when this goes out, but I think if it goes out in between the two-parter, then we are going to be going backward and forward in time. And that might confuse people. But at the moment, I am good. And we are at the end of June, and at the end of July, and obviously, you know, the first days of August, it's Star Trek Las Vegas. And I've got a countdown, and it keeps counting down. And I think we're 41 days away, something like that, before we fly off. So, very excited.
Man, that does sound great. I wish I could be there. Especially since you... Is it just the wife or all the kids?
Oh, no, it's just the wife. So, okay. The children will be kept at home under supervision by my mum. so I'm actually getting my mum to come over. Because my mum doesn't even live in England, so I'm flying her back to England for the sole purpose of being able to look after the kids. Because I'm not going to pay... honestly, by the time you've got like an extra 5 tickets to fly across the Atlantic, you're down like, what, somewhere around $4,000. And yeah. I'm not paying that to take the kids somewhere that they actually just don't want to be.
Well, you could always sell a Tesla.
No, that doesn't solve any of the problems.
So tell me something. Since we did talk, the wife still hadn't known
in the
about
future.
The Tesla.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
No, actually, this will... I am going to put out part two first, so this would be after part two.
Okay, good.
Yeah, they've already talked about it. So, how'd that go?
No, hang on. You're laughing here. It went astonishingly well.
Really?
She was extremely happy and pleased. And she's actually been away this week, actually. She went away early on this week. She had to go and visit her parents. And then she's actually out tonight on a hen do. And you know, she's taken the car on both occasions. She thinks it's the greatest thing ever.
Wow. Don't ever give her up. Hey,
well, I'm not
out there. I bought that. Yeah,
I'm not planning to. I'm not planning to give her up.
You better not, because you know you'll never find one like Kate again.
But it's good, though. It's good. It really is. It's really nice, and it works, and it does exactly what it's supposed to do. Yeah. And I'm honestly very, very happy with it. Now, I think some people might have been a bit confused as to, you know, whether or not I have to discuss things with the wife in it ahead and stuff like that. And the reason why we don't, well, in this particular case, I didn't, is that we're, the wife and I, we've been married for nearly 20 years. It's 20 years this year. And we kind of know each other extremely well. So it means that I'm able to go out on the limb a little bit and get her, you know, get surprises. And by the way, I didn't just surprise her with the car. I also surprised her with the Vegas trip. She had no idea that that she was being dragged over to a Star Trek convention. Actually, sorry, the more I say this out loud, the more I realize that, yeah, actually, perhaps I am extremely lucky, and I shouldn't.
I'd say you are. All right, well, good for you. I'm glad it worked out for you. So, Okay, well then, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. Synopsis is, when a renegade Vulcan, who laughs by the way, captures the Federation Klingon and Romulan ambassadors on Nimbus 3, otherwise known as the Planet of Galactic Peace, it can only mean one thing. The vacation is over. Captain James T. Kirk and his crew of the new Starship Enterprise Bloody A are pressed back into service to come to the rescue. But when the Vulcan has a prior association with Spock, yeah, it allows him to seize control of the Enterprise and put it on a course for the center of the galaxy, where they get to very quickly, by the way, where he and his followers believe they can find the place from which creation sprung. How's that for a...
Yeah. So this actually, this is an awesome story then. This sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, of course. Let's see here. Oh, I should have read this earlier because this has absolutely nothing on the cast and crew. Didn't we go through this last time for Star Trek IV?
I don't recall. Everyone knows who the cast of the original series.
But we do have some guest stars that we like to give. So let's find some guest stars. How about Lawrence Luckinbill as Cybok? Cord was played by Charles Cooper. Cynthia Gao as Caitlin Dar. Todd Bryant as Captain Claw. Oh, and my goodness, we can't forget the most important person of all. George Murdoch plays God.
Okay, so George Murdoch, he is God. He is also Admiral Hansen, right?
Is he?
Or am I crazy on that? But I thought he was someone else that was in Trek that I have forgotten.
You mean in a previous place?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's previous or if it's into the future.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, I don't remember there. Okay. Let's see here. Anyway, so I guess that's pretty much the big players of this. High Priestess was played by Beverly Hart. Amanda played by Cynthia Blase. And McCoy's father was played by Bill Quinn. So, of course, it's when he kills. Mm-hmm. I guess that's pretty much the important people. So, let's see. This was... The story was by William Shatner, Harve Bennett, and David Lowery, with the screenplay by Lowery. And this was directed by the reason why it failed, William Shatner. I don't know if that's the reason why it failed, but yeah.
So you're not a fan of this film then?
No, I'm not. But it's most definitely not what came before it. I mean, it's been better. The previous movie was awesome. The movie before that was good. And the movie before that is arguably one of the best. But the movie before that was probably worse than this one. In some ways, there are a few couple moments that are pretty cool, pretty funny. All those guys running to see Uhura naked. I mean, you know, why the hell not? But as far as the story, blah. What about you, Doc?
Okay, so I have tried to put out as many warnings as I possibly can as to how unsuitable I am to be brought onto a podcast where we discuss things, because I'm always very often very positive about certain things. I would really like to know why there's so much hate for this film. Now, I'm not saying that it's a Star Trek Wrath of Khan. Of course it's not. And I'm not saying that it's as good as Undiscovered Country. Because I absolutely love Undiscovered Country. And I understand that there are certain things in Star Trek IV that are very different and I think are successful. And I've got a big soft spot for Star Trek I. You know, the motion picture, they try to achieve something very, very grand. This is a lot... This is different, this movie. This is... I think it's a relatively simple story. I think it's almost like an action-adventure story of the week. To be honest with you, given that they go through the galactic barrier, I see similarities with where No Man Has Gone Before, and I don't. I think that had this been an episode, this would have been. I think this would have been a fine episode. I think when it gets put up on the screen now. I think that there's a lot of sloppy things going on, by the way. I know that a lot of people will criticize Shatner, and I do think that there's much more sloppiness that is put onto the screen than at any other time, in almost probably the rest of the films put together, and we can discuss that. But really from a story perspective and how it's written, is it really that bad? I mean, I really will enjoy going through this because... I don't think I had seen this episode, this movie in, I'm going to say 20 years, something like that, so, something of that order of magnitude. And I, in fact, I had a hard job tracking this thing down. And it's silly nonsense, and you don't leave it thinking, you know, that's awesome, and you know, I can't wait to go and get, a copy of this film signed by the director at a convention. You know, no one's doing that, but. Is it objectionable and painful? Well, we'll find out.
Oh, and I did forget to mention that Harve Bennett does do a cameo in this as Admiral Bob.
Oh, really? Is that Harve Bennett?
That's Harve Bennett there.
I had no idea. Really? Yep. Okay, I did not know that.
I found a better listing of who was who here. Melanie Shatner plays Yeoman.
Now, is that... I mean, I assume... Okay, let me just... Actually, I don't know, so let me ask. Is that Shatner's daughter? Must be, right? I would have
don't
thought.
Know. I can only... I can assume that she is, but she's the one that hands Kirk his uniform. Let's see here.
Because I know that... Yes, it isn't is. There... Okay, isn't there an issue where I think on the Blu-ray or on the DVD when they were re-releasing these, like 10 years ago or whatever, I think that the director's commentary that is done is also done with his daughter, which I kind of find really weird, right? It's like, I mean, maybe I'm gonna just completely show a huge amount of naivety here, but I kind of don't expect a director's. I mean, so first of all, Shatner's daughter's not, maybe again, stepping out. I don't think she's particularly well known as an actress. So the idea of going to the director's commentary and then seeing that, you know, he's brought his daughter along, that always was a little bit odd. You don't expect it, you know, if Tarantino does his own director's commentary, I don't know if he does or not. I doubt he brings his daughter along if he has a daughter. I don't know. But it was always something that I always found a little bit funny.
Yeah, it says she's the youngest daughter of William and younger sister to Lisbeth and Leslie Shatner. So, yeah, it looks like he had three girls.
Girls are good.
Okay, so girls are good. Sometimes. Depends on the drama. Okay, so we begin the movie on Nimbus 3, the planet of galactic peace. And we see this guy who really, really needs a dentist. Badly needs a dentist. Digging for what? What do you think he's digging for? Gold? Oil? Maybe water? So they're on a... Looks like it was a desert.
Yeah, I don't know why. I always assumed there was water. Like, But there must be better technology to find than whatever he's looking for. In particular, if it's water, right?
Has to be.
That wouldn't be too hard to locate in the 21st century.
No, it shouldn't be. But suddenly, someone approaches him riding a horse. At least, I think it might be a horse. I'm not sure. And there's something strange about this guy. He wants to help him confront his pain.
Oh, you know about my pain.
Who is this magic man? Because he sure makes a guy feel a whole lot better once he gives him a hug. That is so sweet. And then he reveals he's a Vulcan. And not just an ordinary Vulcan. He's a goofy one. He's got a goofy, goofy laugh to him. Okay, so what do you think of the intro so far?
Okay, so I think this is good. So I'm going to claim that this is good because I think that I think Star Trek films in particular, they have problem with antagonists. I mean, with the exception of Khan, and I'm talking about Khan in The Wrath of Khan here, not in Into Darkness or anything. I think that there's always a problem with antagonists. I don't think that they are. I think they're always kind of, they play second fiddle. And in a way, to be honest with you, I think I think it stems from the TV show where you effectively don't have antagonists per se that often. You have problems you have to solve. You have interactions, but this film does kind of bring the antagonist, front and center. You start with him. You start with him, mysteriously being there. And I know that other films do start with something like that. I think, doesn't Nemesis technically start with the attack on the Romulan Senate? Mm-hmm. But here, I think it's very clear that the focus is on this one dude, and he is, we know a bit about Vulcans. This guy doesn't come across as being typical Vulcan, and he's doing something. And he also makes a statement that, he can get he can get a starship. So I think that it's a kind of like a, I think it's a nice kind of like a nice introduction, to be honest. I like it. And when you look back on Star Trek III or Star Trek, Star Trek III, who's the antagonist there? No one really. Star Trek I, no antagonist. No antagonist in Insurrection, really. No real antagonists I'm going to claim there's not really one in Generations either.
Hold on. Antagonist. Don't you mean, wouldn't V'ger be the antagonist? Khan be the antagonist?
Sure. The thing is, I don't think
Klingons
that I think
in three.
Yeah, but there's no real guy in three, right? That's coming forward, and I know that there's I know that there's the main character, and it's I have had enough of you.
Yeah,
sure, but. You never. I always felt that introduction is always. It always felt added on to the story. The story was that you wanted to go back and you wanted to save Spock, and you needed something to ramp up the tension. In one, you had these deep philosophical discussions that you wanted to have whilst watching like a 20-minute pan-in shot of the Enterprise with some classical music in the background. And at the end, you thought, well, we might as well throw V'ger in there as something you have to overcome. Mm. And similar, frankly, with Voyage Home, right? Are we really going to claim that Probe is an antagonist? You certainly can't relate to Probe, right? It's much more of a, it's something that the characters are a situation the characters are placed in order to move forward. So I think it's relatively rare that you start with a dude and then you put a lot of focus on the dude, and it's very clear that this is going to be, whether you like it or not, this is a story between him and how he interacts with Kirk, at least until you get to the end and then God takes over.
Yeah. Okay. All right, well, meanwhile, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy walk into a bar. No, that's not it. They're on vacation at Yosemite National Park. And, each are doing their own thing. Spock, we don't know where he's at. Probably going through Kulinar or something. Well, McCoy is about to have a heart attack because he's watching Kirk climb El Capitan. So what do you think of the effects of what looks like Kirk on the side of a mountain? Which, obviously, he's probably, what, 5 feet in the off the ground? And
okay, so I remember, I mean, as I mentioned, I don't think I'd seen this for 20 years. Now, 20 years ago, I think I had a 21-inch television.
Yeah.
And in standard definition, and I think the last copy of this I owned was on VHS. Now, let me just give you the runaround that I had to do in order to find a copy of Final Frontier in order to review it. I ended up hiring it, quote-unquote, from Amazon, which cost me, I think it was £4.49 for the high-definition feed. I ended up watching that, unfortunately, falling asleep about a third of the way through, and then it lapsed, so I then had to hire it again. At this point, I refused to pay for the high-definition feed, and I think I paid like £3.50. So I watched it then, and then that one lapsed as well because I got busy. And in the end, I think it was earlier on this week, I went to a local kind of like a video shop, DVD shop, and I bought myself a copy of it, and I was prepared to buy the Blu-ray, but they didn't have it. So I ended up paying $5.99, I remember that one, for a DVD copy of this. Because, by the way, none of the films are on Netflix in the UK. Netflix, I mean, a lot of people in the US will claim that Netflix is all great. It's quite barren in the UK compared to what you guys get in the US. So you certainly can't find any Star Trek films on this it. Case, our client lost his alibi. I've spent like the best part of £15 getting a copy of The Final Frontier, which I now have, and I've got it onto my media server now, and it will be there forever, and I'll enjoy it to my heart's content. But the last time I watched this originally was in VHS, and also I was a little bit younger. And then as I kind of got more into Trek, you begin to read things like Industrial Light and Magic weren't available for the special effects. And they claimed that there was a real step down in special effects, and they claimed that a lot of the stuff wasn't done properly. And I know that they've had, when Shatner falls, his shirt changes, and it's Spock's shirt changes, etc., etc. But as a younger kid, I never noticed any of this. So this was really the first time I was sitting there thinking, okay, let's see how bad it is, and let's see how bad I suppose it would be now that I'm watching it really for the first time on a screen bigger than 21 inches and a resolution greater than 300 lines or whatever VHS used to be once you've got the widescreen thing borders. Okay, so anyway, not great, and I think this is one of in terms of what does it look like, and this is one of the things I might. I mean, looking at a lot of the commentary around the film, there's a lot of hatred towards how competent Shatner was, both in terms of, I think, physically getting his vision onto the screen, and then also in how self-centered the particular film is. So it's all revolves around Shatner. And I can very easily perhaps just suggest that for a first time in director that Shatner was, he's probably not that experienced on getting someone up El Capitan and being filmed in a believable way. Now, I don't have huge problems with it. I mean, do you like any of this stuff in Yosemite?
I didn't find any problems with that really per se, because I mean he's up there and he's looking around and it sure looked real because he looks down and you see he's clearly way 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 above all the trees. I mean, you're right. There were no CGI, right? The effects weren't really there, but I didn't have a problem with that.
Now, does Shatner come across as someone that has the upper body strength in order to climb this mountain?
No, I don't really think so.
Because I found that quite fantastical. I really did. I mean, I'm not a rock climber, but I just got the impression that I'd be surprised if Shatner could walk up the mountain if there were stairs, let alone climb it.
Exactly. Plus the fact that he has no safety gear.
Yep, other than Spock.
Well, yeah, but he didn't know he was there. So, you know, when he falls, he's just going to fall. But it was kind of a nice view. You can see him on the side of this mountain climbing up and all the earth below him. So it wasn't bad. It didn't seem bad. I think McCoy had the better job of sitting there watching him, talking to himself. Son of a... I don't get it, but...
Actually, can I say, I think that I'm pretty sure I watched Final Frontier before I watched Wrath of Khan. I think that's the order which I watched them, because it was around the time that this started coming out that I started getting the videos, and it would have been like a new release, whereas Wrath of Khan would have been like a much older release. And one thing that I do enjoy about the film, I do enjoy the fact that there's the Spock, Spock, McCoy, and Kirk relationship or interactions. And I've always enjoyed the scene, you know, that comes later on in terms of the, you know, when they're out camping. I enjoy that. And I think in general, you know, McCoy does, he does perfectly well with what he's asked to work with in this show. Mm-hmm. And I do like the fact that those three of them, you know, the three people are together, right? I know there's some debate about how quickly people turn on Shatner, or how quickly people turn on Kirk once, you know, the Vulcan comes aboard and starts whispering sweet nothings in their ear. I actually felt that the trio of Spock, Kirk, and McCoy, I actually felt that the dialogue and the writing that they have, I think is, I really enjoy it. I think it's quite good.
Oh yeah, they were meant to be together. They're meant to be together, yes.
And it certainly focuses on them, right? And we haven't seen, you know, this story perhaps more than any other. And obviously, either with Voyage Home or Search for Spock, it's hard because Spock's dead. Mm-hmm. And also in the first film, Spock is effectively, he's left. So it is hard to have the trio in the same way that they were in the original series. But I kind of feel that this is one of the first, I'll go as far as saying this is really the first time we see, you know, the trio together throughout the entirety of the film. I mean, Wrath of Khan does have it, of course, but I do enjoy the relationship and how it's portrayed.
Oh yeah, because they're on shore leave. They're supposed to be having fun.
Okay, would you go on shore leave with your boss?
Yeah, but he's a boss and best friend. I mean, where else have these three got to go? I don't believe McCoy has any family. Kirk, you know, there's really no one. Now Sam's dead. Really, there's nowhere for them to go, so why not just go camping with each other?
Yep, sure.
I mean, if I had a tight friendship with my boss, yeah, I probably would.
And I find it funny that Sulu and Chekhov go off together as well.
Yeah, right.
That's almost that. It's almost tragic.
Yes. Okay, so, well, anyway, Spock stops by to make sure Kirk is one with the rock. But Kirk says, if you don't leave me alone, I'm liable to fall. And down he goes. So, really, that must have been a very long way up, because he sure does fall for a long time. Although, I would have expected the fall to last about no more than, 4 seconds, and boom, you're done. But it does take a while, but believe it or not, Spock was able to save him about 3 inches away from a rock.
Yeah, and another thing that comes up, I mean, if someone pulls you back as you're going, you know, 50 miles an hour into a rock, and they prevent you from hitting the floor, the force that they're going to apply to you is going to be the same as you hitting the floor. So it's not just good enough to catch someone a second before they hit the floor. You kind of have to grab them early enough so you can gradually slow down. You know, there's no difference, you know, hitting a floor or having your legs ripped out from Spock behind you.
Oh yeah.
And
plus the fact that Kirk's spleen is now in his nose. You know, I mean, every internal organ would have been jarred and pushed up. So, that wouldn't have worked.
No. But, you know, can it be classified as an action scene? I'm not entirely sure. But it's something to get the, to get the film off rolling.
Mm-hmm. Oh, like Kirk says, he knew he wasn't going to die. Even as he fell, he knew all the time, I'm not going to die. Because he wasn't alone. And let's go into that a second. Because we know how Kirk dies eventually, for real this time. He wasn't alone there either.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've heard people. I don't know how kind of true it is, but he dies on the bridge, right? Not on the bridge of a starship.
But yeah, I was going to say on a bridge.
And a lot of people claim that that's like intentional. It's like, yeah, Kirk died on the bridge.
He died on the bridge.
Okay, well, maybe something was lost in translation there, because that was the original hope. But also, if Kirk knows that he's going to die alone, then why is he telling Spock to shoo and to stay away? You know, surely, okay, although Spock increases the chance of maybe he slips, if he knows he's not going to die if Spock's around, then, I would certainly be going on holiday with Spock. As long as I can.
Well, yeah. So if Spock had never bothered him, do you think he would have made it to the top of the mountain or had fallen anyway?
I'm not sure. I don't have enough imagination to be able to believe he would have reached the top. But then again, I don't have enough imagination to believe he actually got to where they showed him, or even the fact that he did his like pull up thing as he's basically holding on by one arm. I just don't think there's enough strength in that arm to lift up one Shatner.
You mean Spock's arm?
No. As the titles are coming up and they're showing Shatner like climbing the rock, I think there's a bit where he ends up hanging by one arm and then he pulls himself up to the rock by one arm because most 55-year-olds can do that.
Well, yeah. Well, see, another thing, as he was going up the rock, I noticed his fingertips were on little tiny ledges while his toes were doing all the work. He was just like walking like normal, and there was nothing, his toes weren't actually on a little ledge on the mountain. It was actually the side of the mountain. So all they needed to do was slip and poof, it's all over. So he shouldn't have been able to climb that way anyway. But, okay. So back on Nimbus 3, we're at one of the most glamorous locations on the planet called Paradise City, where we're in what I would describe as a biker bar with three titted girls dancing on top of the bar. By the way, I call them cat women.
Hey, Lou, what goes on in Vegas stays in Vegas, right?
That's right. So, but they're playing an unfriendly game of pool. I'm not sure what that was all about. A pool table with water on it. Is that an actual game, or is that something that they devised?
I think it's as real as the three-breasted lady.
Yeah, that could be. All right. Well, anyway, in a secret meeting location, we have these three people having their secret meeting. One's a Federation representative who is half drunk. One is a Federation representative. The second is a half-drunken, belching Klingon. And the third is the new face in town, a Romulan chick.
So here's one thing I don't like about the films, and this is a lot of the films, not just this one. I don't like it when they keep changing the design of various aliens. This Roman mm-hmm. doesn't look like a Romulan.
No.
It really doesn't. And I know that that the flip side to this is Nemesis, where basically you end up with TNG Romulans that do look a little bit out of place given the budget that they had. But this woman doesn't look Romulan. I just don't. I find it hard to take.
Nope. And her ears were covered too, so we don't even know if she has the Romulan ears. All right. Well, anyway.
She sounded like a Romulan that had spent her childhood growing up at an English boarding school as well. Mm. And maybe that's also something I couldn't quite see past.
There you go. Maybe it was. A Romulan abducted her from an English boarding school. That makes sense. Okay, so they're about to be under attack and taken prisoner. Well, prisoner by whom? That goofy Vulcan. And his new followers of peace and love, man. Okay, so meanwhile, back on the Enterprise, or actually on the Enterprise, we have Mr. Scott almost trying to rebuild the bloody ship. That he hates that shit, doesn't he? Nothing seems to work. The doors don't work. Even the red alert doesn't work. What have they done to him?
I mean, to be honest with you, it seems to me that Scott is generally just at this point he appears to be like an IT engineer, putting up with the latest Windows, like, you know, bug fix Tuesday rollout.
Mm-hmm. And besides, when did Scotty lose his command abilities? Why would Chekhov be in command?
Well, I mean, Scott is busy.
Uh-huh. But when there's something going on, like an emergency, why would Chekhov be in command? Darn it. There goes the shower. Somebody had to take a shower now. Hmm. Oh, well.
Oh, we'll give them 2 minutes.
Yeah, no kidding. So, anyway, okay. Alright. Sulu and Chekhov as lost sheep. What do you think of them two? That was pretty funny. Don't tell him we're lost, he'll never live it down.
Now, I think the beginning, right, is just that you're going around all of the characters that you know and you're just introducing them one by one.
Yeah.
You know, you're just, or not one by one, in this case it's three, two and two. Yeah. But you're just picking everyone up. So, you know, it did what it had to do. I do find it a bit unusual that you would go on holiday with your, with your work colleague. In particular, because at this point, I mean, Chekhov at least must have a daughter, right? Hmm. No, sorry, Chekhov has a daughter.
Sulu.
Sulu has a daughter. Did whatever happened to Chekhov? Did he ever have family? In canon?
I couldn't tell you. I don't know.
I think although he's seen in Generations, he's really there as a... Really, nothing happens, right? And then he doesn't get picked up in TNG. Yeah, no, but maybe he has a daughter as well. Who knows?
No. I don't know. Maybe he does. Okay, so... And what was it, the deal with this Uhura coming on to Scotty? Oh, lass. Oh. At least it looked to me like maybe she was coming on to him.
So as a young kid, I never thought that she was coming on, quote unquote. I then read a lot of stories about, oh yeah, Uhura comes on to him. But when I watched it, I didn't think it was that clear cut. So I'm just, I personally took it as being, you know, some old friends that are slightly flirty.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, just she's a little flirty.
Mm.
She's just trying to make him feel good since he's going through hell on the ship. All right, so Kirk, Spock, and McCoy decide to have some dinner. Beans. McCoy's beans. It has a certain flavor. Tennessee whiskey.
Mm-hmm. And that's the bit where the way that Spock says, oh, there's a flavor I'm not quite familiar with. So yeah, that's the secret ingredient. So, oh, Bones, can you pass us some more of the secret ingredient?
Yep, Tennessee whiskey. But then all of a sudden the mood changes when McCoy goes into how precious life is. And geez, you two. You two suck. You're going to make me die an early death. Oh, well. What do you think of the marshmallow replicator?
Okay, so I have big problems with this. Because I never knew what a, quote, marshmallow was. And be aware that when you have a lot of TV and movies and stuff imported from another country, you sometimes think, oh, it's an American thing. But I'm still, you know, I'm still 20 years on, and I haven't found a good explanation as to why are they growing up marshmallows here? What is this nonsense? What's a marshmallow? A lot
of unnecessary sugar. No, you toast it. You put it in a flame and toast it, and then you can even make s'mores with it. You know, a graham cracker, a marshmallow, and some chocolate.
No, but they're marshmallows, right? Mellow, not
melon. Oh, melon versus mellow.
That's a
very good question, and I can't answer that, to be honest.
I mean, according to Memory Alpha, because I did have to look this up to think, because I was, you know, I didn't want to come across as an idiot here. Apparently it's something to do with, it's in canon, it's supposed to be a joke that McCoy plays on Spock before they leave the ship. But you can't just have that as the explanation. So I'm thinking, you know, all the way as I'm growing up, or you know, for the last 10 years or so, I'm thinking, oh, it just must be that Americans are a little bit weird, in the same way you call, you know, lifts elevators, and apparently a sweater is something you wear. But you know, I got really confused by it.
I think you might be right, because I can't see anything about marshmallow. But yet they do say marshmallow.
And not only does Spock call it that, but then they call it... It's McCoy does as well.
Huh. Yeah, marshmallow.
So that always bugged me. Now, I love, I have to say, I love the campfire scene, and I love the row, row, row your boats, and all of that is great. And I do also like the fact that the film comes back round and they end on it as well. And they end on it in a really good way, because they end on it in a way that then rolls into the theme, into the main score. And I have to say that the music in this film is, I'm going to claim it's good. I think it's great music. I think the score is very good, and it's... I think it's a tad TNG, but as far as that goes, I'm not going to complain.
Toast and marshmallow. That'll be there. A marshmallow.
Okay, the only thing I can think of is I found this website here, and I listened to it, and maybe just Spock says it wrong. He says marshmallow when he says when he wants to say marshmallow, and McCoy's just making fun of him. Got it. Okay, so that the row your boat doesn't go very good, so they decide to get some sleep. Meanwhile, the flagship of the Klingon Empire is shooting tiny little satellites that are floating through space, because that's what all good warriors do. And
that's not the flagship, is it?
No, of course not. He's a nobody. Did you notice, I don't know if you've heard it, but it seems like when he shoots at that satellite, it screams.
Yeah.
So you think it did too?
Yeah, so, no, I think that's exactly what happened. So here's the thing. I mean, already there are a couple of things that have taken me out of the film. And I do think that it's ultimately the director's responsibility for this, right? I think it's a great start. I then start thinking, you know, I'm not entirely sure Kirk can climb that rock. Then he falls over down. I think the way that the scent is cut makes it rather unbelievable and a bit farcical. You then have the marshmallow thing that I have not got a clue as to why they're saying, and I'm left baffled. And then you've got the introduction of a you know, of the Klingon, so you think, oh, this is exciting. And you've got kind of like a sound effect that makes it sound like shooting something in space makes the thing go, ow, ow. And I'm thinking, ow, ow. What's happening here? And I don't necessarily think that this was, you know, sometimes you can have a director's vision that they're trying to put across. But I think we're a lot closer to, yeah, it'll do territory. Let's move on. I've run out of budget than anything else. So I find that a lot of these questionable things. Oh, actually, also, I had a moan about the Romulan as well. So a lot of these kind of small things have just made me a bit, you know, it doesn't quite flow nicely. That there are too many things that just cause me to step out and go, you know, if only they had done that, or if only they had changed, you know, a small line here, it would have been a lot nicer, a nicer experience to watch.
Hmm. Sounds like this movie is full of flaws, doesn't it? Okay. All right, so the Enterprise, I guess, limps along trying to help out as best it can as Kirk watches a hostage tape where the bad guy, Cybok, shows himself, which then sends Spock into investigative mode as to who he is. Because he believes he knows this Vulcan. And we all find out later that Sarek was, Sarek was a slut, wasn't he?
Okay, do you have a problem with Spock having a brother?
The only thing is that Sarek apparently married two different human females while probably cheating on one of them with the Vulcan princess.
Well, things I don't have that much of a problem with it, and I don't even have a problem that it's not been referenced yet. In particular, you can always claim, right, that Sarek's like 100 years old, so, you know, there was his first wife, you know, 50 years ago, and his second wife 30 years ago, and, you know, the way that they kind of things work in the Vulcan world, I can kind of buy into it. Now, considering that as soon as Cyborg actually sees Spock, he goes, "Hey, Spock!" and knows him straight away. I'm a little bit taken aback that Spock seems to be so, you know, he's very, you know, very cautious, and he's very, you know. So if you were Cyborg versus if you were Spock, you know, who's the most surprising to be seen? You know, Cyborg, who said, "Oh, I'm going to go on a journey. I'll probably be back in a couple of years," which is his story, or Spock, who was certified dead. So why isn't Cybok the one that's going, "Holy moly, when did they resurrect you, dude?"
Yeah, I hadn't heard about that yet. Dad kept me out of the loop. But I always figured that it was the Vulcan princess that turned Sarek off of Vulcan women forever.
So, okay.
But don't worry. Spock doesn't have a sister. We know he doesn't have a sister. He might get a stepsister someday.
Maybe. I mean who knows? Who knows?
You know, Sarek may, since they can't have girls, he may want to adopt a girl someday in the future, or, okay, so, or in the past, or something. We don't know.
So you think like Sarek has like, the, it's Sarek's foster home. And he has tens and dozens of kids coming through.
Yes.
I think that'd be quite cool, right? I want a spin-off series with Sarek's foster home.
Sarek's foster home. That's a great idea. Okay. So, to rescue the prisoners, they need to infiltrate the bad guy. Or take him into custody. And what do? They use Uhura to do a sexy dance, supposedly naked, which, by the way, I have scoured that movie back and forth and forward and back and freeze frame and frame by frame, and I don't think she's naked, do you?
what a question.
It's the important stuff that we need to discuss.
I do not know. Perhaps we should ask Nichelle if we see her.
Actually, you know something? Do you remember, I hate to even say this, but do you remember 2 years ago when we were at Las Vegas and she was talking?
Yes.
And didn't I tell you then, I believe she's got Alzheimer's because they kept asking
you didn't tell
what
me that.
You didn't hell that. Yes. Oh no, okay, let me refresh your memory.
I think you told me I wouldn't book her for next year this far in advance or something, which is a horrendous thing to say.
I didn't think she'd die or anything. I just said that she's got dementia because they were asking her what it was like, you know, how did Martin Luther King get her to stay in there? And she's talking about how she got females into space. And then they went back to it again. But, well, you know, what happened with Dr. King? And she started to tell a story. And I was the one who got females into space. And she just kept reverting back to it. She couldn't understand what they were asking. I saw that 2 years ago. I said, I know she's got dementia. And now it would appear that they're finally coming out with that. From what I've been reading, that she may have a small form of dementia. And that is sad. I'm sad about that.
Well, I mean, I don't know what her, like, her personal situation is, and I would probably not, I probably wouldn't be able to diagnose from afar. But one thing I do have to say, I think that she came to Star Trek, Destination Star Trek in London. I don't remember if it was the first time or the second time, but it was certainly in London, as opposed to they've, you know, more recently moved it to Birmingham. there's a baffling decision for you. Sorry, I'm going to really offend anyone that lives north of Watford with that one. When I saw her in Star Trek, in Destination Star Trek London, she was great. She was really, really good, and she has a lot of stories, and she's got a lot of. She's very eloquent in terms of how she describes it all. But one thing that I was really, really impressed by is that I think that because she's getting older, she does need someone to curate. And one thing that doesn't happen at Destination Star Trek is that they don't have the people on stage to curate and to handle the questioning. Now, some people can go one-on-one with an audience. That's you know, but that fundamentally is a skill that you need, and it sometimes not everyone. And there's not necessarily a reason why actors should be able to do that. But I remember that Robert Picardo curated her when she was in London, and it was completely out of nowhere. And he mentioned it that, you know, they happened to be on the same flight over, and they were chatting, and they got, you know, they got speaking and stuff. And the way Robert Picardo actually treated her and was able to be kind of, you know, the go between the audience and the show was actually really, you know, really very, very touching to see. Because, you know, you're up on stage, you can't hear the questions very much. You know, you're likely to get, I'm going to get some hatred now. You're likely to get some kind of broad, Scouse-accented northerner ask a question, which is hard for people that are not used to the accents to understand. And right. You can look very, very bad. And I think that Robert Picardo in particular, when, you know, he just did an awesome job at basically protecting her and making sure that thing flowed very well. So yeah, I mean, I wanted to actually speak to quote unquote the doctor about that, let him know that I think he did a very good job. But anyway, it now comes out 4 years later in a podcast, and no one will hear. But there we are.
There we are.
Oh, one thing I do remember, and going back to the film, it's only in hindsight, because again, I didn't know this at the time. But you can tell that Shatner directed this, because they land and they go, "Who, you know, how could we possibly get from here to there in a world that has, you know, shuttles and transporter beams and all the rest of it? I know, let's go and find some horses." And you can tell that they're doing the horse scene because Shatner loves horses. Mm-hmm. So there's no reason for the horses other than Shatner loves horses. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they were his horses.
Well, I mean, it could be the only life on that planet, the only means of moving around, I guess. I don't know. So anyway, okay. So they try to rescue the prisoners, but they actually become... They get taken hostage. Cybok won the battle. And hence begins his religious journey. But first, Kirk has a Catwoman jump him from behind, and he kills her. And how does he kill her? He tosses her into some water. What was that? I mean you, maybe your head hit the ball?
Do you have cats? They don't like water. They don't like water at all.
No, they don't. But, I mean, he throws her, and boom, she dies.
Now, I do have to say, I do find it odd that, and again, because you know that Shatner's a certain type of person, and because you know that he's kind of got more power over this film than any other, when you do see the scene played out, I can't help but kind of flash forward in my mind to a point where he's like discussing with the producer and says, "So Captain Kirk will be fighting with a three-breasted cat lady." And it's like, do we really need that in the film? So what do you mean
absolutely
in the film? Oh yeah, yeah. Sure. We'll have the cameras rolling as we do this, but Captain Kirk needs the fight with the Cassian lady without question. And you start thinking, yeah, I think that's more of a Shatner request than an actual integral part of the plot.
Yeah, exactly. So the cat lady jumps his back. Wait. How many breasts does the cat lady have? What, two, Bill? Why would she have more than two? I think that she should have three.
Okay, so here's the thing. I'm pretty sure that these Cajuns have six. I'm sure they must have, like, because a cat has more than three, right? And also, yes, the idea of having three in a row is a bit weird. So it's come to this. We're having a chat about cat ladies. But I would imagine that they would have six. I think six seems more kind of appropriate.
I think what he really wanted was a four-breasted woman, but they had to settle for three. Which he probably wanted three to begin with, so he got what he wanted. Imagine that. William Shatner getting what he wants.
Do you think he did the fight scene himself, or do you think he had a stunt double?
Probably stunt double, yeah. He had to, if he's that much of a fighter.
I'm sorry, I'm at this point where I'm thinking where they needed the scene where, you know, Cat Lady locks her legs around his head, I'm thinking Shatner's not letting that go to a stunt double.
That's true. You might be right there. All right, so I love it when Spock arrives and lets Cybok know that he's under arrest. Spock has a sense of humor. That's funny stuff. He's the one in custody, but Cybok, you're under arrest. Oh, okay.
No, that part's played well, right? I like that part. That's quintessential Spock. And that's quintessential, kind of, you know, someone who knows Spock reacting to Spock still being stubborn after all these years. I like that a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm a sucker.
I know, but I mean, the fact that Spock's actually the one in, you know, under guard, but he still tells him you're under arrest. Spock, that's funny. These are very serious charges. Okay. But that's what, now we find out later that Cybok is a son of Sarek, as we mentioned, his half brother. So, what do you think about how Cybok can get others to follow him? I mean, he helps them face their pain, and all of a sudden they're committed. Do you think there's any trickery going on? Or any under the influence of something going on, because it just happens so easy. Like with McCoy, he makes him face the fact that he killed his father to help him die in peace when there would have been a cure lately. So now he helps him face that, and all of a sudden now Bones is in it. He's on his side. Chekhov. I wonder what Chekhov's pain was. Maybe the worms in his ear. I don't know. Or Sulu's pain. What was Sulu's pain? You know, being called tiny?
You didn't go home to look after your kids.
Right, right. That could be. But what is it that he does that all of a sudden not only helps them, their pain is gone, but turns them on his side so easily? I wish they would have explained that more.
No, Jean, but, you know, we do kind of know that, you know, Vulcans are telepaths of sort, right? They, mm-hmm. you know, I do think it's, is it, I don't actually, maybe it's, it can't be controlled because he seems to be getting, it can't be kind of, you know, controlled in the sense of mind control because he seems to be getting more and more and more people. Yeah. And also people are, you know, are acting in a certain way when they're away from him as well. Whether it's kind of trickery in terms of just a leader that is able to deliver something and people are then very keen to pledge their allegiance. It does seem a bit far-fetched, in particular for the, you know, for the professional guys, right? You know, going up to a dude that's seen better times in the middle of nowhere digging for water is one thing, but, you know, Sulu and Chekhov and Uhura should be, I mean, they should be professionals, and they shouldn't be fooled with this kind of stuff. I think that because he's a Vulcan, I can let it go and not be too fussed. But it is certainly something that, you know, if someone else were there saying, "Look, I can't, you know, I can't accept this nonsense," I would completely, you know, I wouldn't berate them for it.
So, okay, let's talk about one other thing. When they bust into the complex on the horses, and Kirk is like, "Spock, Spock," and Spock is trying to scan. He says, "Hold your horse, Captain." I mean, that's kind of funny. You wouldn't expect Spock to say, "Hold your horse." Isn't nope. that an expression? Like, you know, calm down?
I'm certain that Shatner wrote that line himself.
Oh, I imagine. Hold your horse, Captain. Of course, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. But they get caught. And they go to the Enterprise where Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are locked in the brig together. And it's the new brig, a brig you cannot escape. How does he know that? Because they tested it with somebody who really, really tried hard and failed. Spock himself. However, they do get broken out. I love that scene where you get the S-T. Stand back. Stand back! That was pretty cool. I love the jailbreak, don't you?
No, I do enjoy it. I find it odd that everyone knows Morse code. But if you're happy to step past that, it's good. Because then as soon as the explosion happens, everyone's like, "What went on?" And then Scotty straight away, "Do you not think?
Do you not know a jailbreak when you see one?"
Do you not know a jailbreak when you see one? And it's like, oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, that's great. And of course, they show up to find him missing. Oh no, we gotta get him. We gotta find him. They go up into a room. I'm trying to think. I don't know what it is, but it was pretty cool. What am I trying to say? You know, when they're on the ship and they're trying to call for help?
Yep.
It's whatever room that is. I'm trying to think, why was it... It seemed so cool, like... I don't know. A bar in there? No, I don't know. What I'm trying to find it. Because I'm trying to remind
myself.
Seems
like the conference room from... it reminded me of the conference room from Star Trek 1.
Is that it? Yeah.
Well, it can't be it because the old Enterprise exploded. But
well, you know, they probably reused a few things. Anyway.
Okay, while you Google, so the turbo lift shaft thing that they
got. Oh, man. What? Yes. The turbo lift. They climbed the turbo lift. And, of course, how many darn decks are on that ship?
So there's a 72 or a 77
deck? 78.
Deck 78. They're also going... They seem to be passing random deck numbers. And so they go past, I think, 72, and then they go past 453, and then they go past something else on the other side. So the way that that's cut, I mean, that's just sloppy, right?
It was sloppy. Yeah, it went like this. When they went up, you could see decks 35, 52, then to 64, then back to 63, then 64, then 65, then 52, then 77, then 78. And that's where they ended at the top there, I suppose. But what's really weird is it was a bad shot when you could see the arm coming out of the wall to hold Spock up. And you could also
I didn't see
very...
that.
What?
I didn't see that.
Oh my god, it was so obvious. Plus the fact that... Okay, this was done in, what, 1992?
No, I think it's 89.
89, yes. Hey, oh, by the way, the original release date for this movie was, which I did forget to give, didn't I? Is June 9th, 1989. So there we go, 1989. Obviously, this film was not intended to be shown frame by frame. But when you do, you can clearly see their stunt
doubles.
Or real
by real, some might argue.
Yeah, I suppose so. You could clearly see their stunt doubles, and you could clearly see the arm coming out of the wall. You know, where it's holding Spock up. So, it's pretty obvious. Those, it's silly.
Now, that thing's... Look, I understand that... Actually, if you look at most turbo lifts, right, there are issues in turbo lifts where it might take them, you know, longer to go from deck 4 to 7 than it takes them to go from deck 5 to 15, and you know there are a lot of inconsistencies on turbo lifts and how they move around and stuff. You know, yeah, it is what it is. Very often, the reason why the turbo lifts are there is that they're cut for pace. There's even the one in is it in Into Darkness or is it in Beyond? Or actually, it might have been in 2009, but there's a very, very quick cut between Shuttle Bay and Bridge, and it's like a very, very quick cut. It's like no more than like 4 or 5 seconds. And you think, yeah, Turbo Lift can't get from the Shuttle Bay to the Bridge in 4 or 5 seconds. But the way that they cut it, it's very dynamic. They're forcefully going from one part of the ship to the other, and you can kind of forgive them taking a little bit of liberty with the physics in order to get, you know, their vision across. Okay, so I'm not arguing that everything has to be consistent, but especially when you yourself as a director are labeling the deck numbers, yeah, and you're going up, and as you're going up, the numbers are getting greater, which is not how the ship works, and then they're not sequential. And then you're going to put this out to a bunch of Star Trek fans who, you know, and I'm not going out on a ledge here, but, you know, we have a certain tendency to notice these things. What are you doing? Look, this film is 30 years on. We're still talking about, and I actively feel pain when I see these things shooting by. And, you know, when the kids watch it with me, they think, why are they in order? And why are the deck numbers getting higher as they're going up to the top of the ship? Don't these people know anything? And it's just sloppy.
Yeah, it should be going the other way around, shouldn't it? Deck 1 should be on top.
Of course.
But anyway, but still, 78 decks? I mean, come on. How many floors were in the World Trade Center?
I think it was over 100. But I think that they've mentioned how many decks there are, right? They've mentioned in Trek before. And, okay, I'm going to completely lose any cred, but on the Enterprise D, isn't engineering in 37 or 36? So you kind of expect there to be no more than like 45 decks. And I think they mention it every now and again. They'll tell you how many decks there are. There aren't 77 decks on the Enterprise A.
Yeah. Plus, like you say, I mean, in the fuselage of the ship, not including the whatever goes up to the nacelle, there's no way it's 78 decks high. So, I mean, yeah, that's an oops. But we don't care.
And maybe the reason why Scotty was so upset is that he's having to go around and repaint all of these deck numbers because they were just nonsense.
That may be. So Bones, his pain is his dad. I'm just guessing that Sulu's pain is being called Tiny, and Chekhov's pain is having those things put in his ears. Now it's time for Spock to face his pain. And what's his pain? His daddy called him human.
Okay, hang on. So I need to watch it. I'm going to step in here and defend. Firstly, I really, really, really like the McCoy backstory.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I think it's good. I think clearly they're depicted in a world where they don't have assisted suicide, and McCoy is placed in the position, in a really very bad position, where he has to, he knows his dad's number's up, and he knows that that the best he can do is he can relieve the pain. And there's also, to me, it sounded like from the dialogue that that was becoming less and less effective. And there's not much you can do other than just, watch your loved one, basically slip out, out of life in a very painful state. And, it is a relatively high level, just, one take of the entire, the question involved. But this is 20 years ago. This is in an action, throwaway action film. And I really thought that story was, I thought that little scene was very good. And you can really... I felt that it was very, it was true to McCoy's character, I felt. I think that he would be conflicted in those circumstances. And then, when he does say that he eventually did help his dad, pass. Several weeks later, there was a cure. And again, that's a kind of like a sucker punch for him as well. And he knows that in reality, he probably still made the right decision, and he, his dad probably wouldn't have survived that long anyway. But it's it is a hit to take, that something that he has to live with. I really enjoyed, I really enjoyed the McCoy story. Anyway, apologies.
It's all right. Yeah, I know. I agree with you 100%. It's a real touching moment in a terrible movie.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
Yep. And, something like this could have, in a better movie, we could have expanded on it. We could have made McCoy trying to help his dad and, trying to help his dad live, but ending with his dad's death. I think that would have been one hell of an episode in and itself. I don't know. You're right. It was a great scene in a terrible movie. That's all.
Now from the Spock's perspective, very often Sarek gets he gets portrayed as being a bigot. I don't know if that's I don't think that's necessarily a fair reflection of Sarek. I'm not entirely sure that Spock's pain would relate to the fact that, as an infant, as he dropped out of his mother, he somehow disappointed his dad. I don't think that Spock has enough. I don't think he has that kind of. I don't. Perhaps pride's the wrong word, but I don't think he would really care what his dad thinks. I think he would be able to view it quite logically and say, "Look, I'm going to do this and." He had issues with his dad where he wouldn't communicate with his dad when going back to the journey to Babel. I don't think he's harboring resentment that his dad felt that he wasn't quite Vulcan enough for him. And I think he would be much more pragmatic. And frankly, I doubt Spock has a lot of pain in terms of how other people have related to him. He might have internal pain and internal conflict between his Vulcan and human side, and he might have to, you know, in a way that you often see these stories about when you do have the split, you know, half Klingon, half human, half Vulcan, half human kind of things, where there's the internal conflict. But I think externally, I just don't feel that it really reflects his character as I identify with him.
Now,
okay, so let's go on. The ship arrives to the Great Barrier and breaks right through. Then they arrive to God's planet. What do you think the planet's name is? Heaven? and when we get to heaven, what do we find? A barren...
Okay, so
desert-like planet.
I didn't like how. So they obviously got the Klingon and the human and the Vulcan and the Romulan on the ship, and in particular on the bridge, so they could all go, oh, look, there is a planet there. You know, now we're believers. Now, you know, now that someone has done something nuts, and apparently the ship hasn't been destroyed by going through the Great Barrier. By the way, where the hell are these great barriers? Because we know the Enterprise, although it's not the same Enterprise, I accept, but it's gone through both the internal galactic barrier and the external galactic barrier as well, between where no one has gone before and the final frontier. So that's like, already that must be more than half the voyage that Voyager needed to do in order to get back home. Mm-hmm. Yet they've done it in, you know, much less time.
It was really fast, too.
Yeah. I mean, in the 24th century, there must be a bunch of nutcases that would be prepared to ram starships as fast as they could into this great barrier if it was some type of pseudo, you know, religious kind of, you know, thing. In fact, that's one thing I think that they give too much emphasis to in the story. I think that they give Cyborg too much time that, you know, could it possibly be that he's found Shakari? I mean, well, you can answer your question pretty quickly. No. Mm-mm. Now let's move on. Even Spock gives him, you know, more time of day than I think he should.
Right. But anyway, they say, well, we're here. We might as well go ahead and see what's on the planet, and we need to go now because God's a very busy man. And I thought, is God really a busy man? I mean, don't you think he's got some underlings that he farms his work out to? You know? He most likely probably watches YouTube videos or people, you know, getting kicked in the balls or something. Or he plays nine ball pool on Facebook. But I'm sure, you know, God farms out his work to other people.
I'm pretty sure he's just sitting there watching, you know, cute cat videos on YouTube.
Exactly. Or, you know, Charlie bit my finger. He probably can't get enough of that, can he? Have you seen that one?
Yeah.
He bit my finger. Well, of course he bit your finger, because you put your finger in his mouth. That hurt, Charlie. It still hurts. Anyway, side note. I actually saw another video of these two grown up, and it was just as stupid as it was before, but it was a cute video. He bit my finger.
Okay.
So they arrive, and after minutes of nothingness, they finally get a little earthquake action and big rocks coming out of the ground. Then we get some smoke and some lights, and there he is. God.
So I'm going to have to confess a couple of things here. I really like the idea of alien being marooned on a planet. For whatever reason, I always find that story to be quite fun. I suppose even going back as far as like Skin of Evil kind of thing. But in particular, when I think about is a power play when they have the you know, where Troy and Data get possessed and they're walking around as the older what was the ship? Can't remember the ship's name. But you know, where the ship crashed and they're supposed to go to the southern polar region.
That's right. Ramsey.
Yeah. I really liked that story because I think it's actually quite I can see it happening, frankly. You know what I mean? And ruin an angry alien there, and then you turn up, and then you get attacked by the spirit. And I think it's a nice story, and I also like the story of, you know, a more powerful alien pretending to be God as well. I always find them interesting because I think really the question it's asking there is that, okay, what exactly does it mean to be human, and how do we react to people that might be perceived, whether rightly or wrongly, as being superior to us. And I think that those are quite nice questions to throw around. So I'm kind of, you know, this isn't a great film, but I'm when it kind of climaxes with, you know, an entrapped alien that is acting like God, I do have a soft spot for this.
Hmm. Well, this, I mean, God seemed like a pretty nice fellow, didn't he?
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Well, I mean, he started to seem like a very nice fellow. Kind of had like a God and Jesus image in one until he, you know, turned on him.
Yep, yep. We...
But
anyway. That's true. That's true.
Yeah. And the curly white hair, the curly beard, he had it all coming on. But then all of a sudden... logic won the day when Kirk says, "Excuse me," and of course now this is a meme that's been everywhere. But excuse me.
Actually, how did this become a meme? Because I
don't know.
I didn't recall this line from the film until like about 5 years ago. It started to become like, you know, a quotable line.
I mean, you know, back in the day, memes weren't the same thing, but now they are. And the whole, what does God need with the starship? You know, that's hilarious if you think about it.
But of course, you know, even nowadays, you don't play it as in that way. It's always, what does God need with a starship? Which is completely unfair, because that's not how it's delivered.
No, it isn't. Excuse me, what does God need with a... Who are you? Who am I? Don't you know? Aren't you God? I mean, that's some good stuff there. And Cybok's out. Oh, he's a non-believer. He'll understand later. So, you know, of course, he gets a lightning bolt thrown at him. And so does Spock. And Bones was next. But Cybok stepped in the way. And, you know, and he realizes that this is no God. This isn't the God of Shockery. Nope, turns out this guy's a prisoner. Prisoner on this ship, on this godforsaken planet. I wonder what he did to become a prisoner on the planet. But we don't get any story about what he did, who he really is, where they're really at, or anything. But
no, we don't.
Nope, but Cybok does destroy himself to help him with his pain.
And something I didn't quite catch here, but we end up defeating the guy by just shooting him in the face. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, it was the Klingon, I don't know
bird
what they're
prey.
Called.
Bird of prey.
Guns. Okay. Klingon guns that took him out in the end.
The disruptors.
Yeah. Yes. And not only that, you know, Kirk is almighty. He even gets the Klingon to apologize. I'm sorry about that. It won't happen again, sir. The Klingon ambassador. Maybe I need to find out who he was again. Because he sure looks a lot like one of the Klingon ambassadors on TNG, doesn't he?
Um, Yeah, I can't place him. I don't think so. I mean, is he not reminding you of like Kempek and stuff?
That's what he kind of reminded me of, but it's not Kempek.
No, it's not.
Not the same guy, but still, he kind of did remind me of him. Anyway. Let's see. So Cybok gives himself to help the ship escape. Couple torpedoes and shooting some guns at it, and God dies. So they killed God. Is there anything else?
So I suppose when you put it like that, right? You know, someone starts forming a cult. They have to go and find God. Shatner turns up. Shatner punches God in the face, and then that's about it. It's a bit of a weird one. But I already mentioned, right, when they go back to Earth and they go back and they have their sing-along on the in the forest, that's nice. That's nice that they've been through.
That's why. I found him. Charles Cooper. He does play Kempek.
Does he?
He does.
No.
According to Memory Alpha. Let me find my Skype, and I will send you a link.
Lou, at some point, do you think we should do like research ahead of these episode reviews?
Yo, I think it's funnier when we wing it and we're trying to figure out what we're doing.
Because I knew why you might say that he looks like Kempek, but I, for the life of me, I thought that it was just a, you know, kind of a false friend, like, you know, big fat Klingon. There must be more than one big fat Klingon.
Yeah, no, believe it or not, crazy as it may sound, but I can't even. Here we go.
They should have.
I was gonna send you the link.
They should have kept him as the same character.
Yeah, I think he was smaller in this movie than he was in TNG, or at least it looks like it. No, maybe not. No, he looks just as fat. He just has different headgear. Yep. General Cord and Kempek. And that, what's funny is he also, as a, you know, he was human at the time, playing a judge on the practice. Smoking judge, as a matter of fact. Yeah, every time I see him playing on something, you hear Kempek coming out. So, anyway. So, I guess then we're back to Yosemite Park singing Row, 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 Row Your Boat.
Yes. Yeah.
We end the movie. I can't think of anything else. Did I miss a lot?
No, I didn't think so.
Anything important? Okay.
No.
Well then, I guess it's time for our final thoughts and ratings on this movie. Or as Austin Powers says, movie. On a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being completely unrealistic. my thoughts are, I'm going to leave this, let's end it on a high note, so I'll tell you my thoughts first. Stupid. I just think it's dumb. There are a few funny parts, there are a few sweet moments, but for the most part, it's junk. I'm sorry. Cybok simply rehashes a painful memory, and now you're under his spell. Cybok, the character who he's a Vulcan who laughs. I don't know. It's just, I'm not exactly sure what the whole purpose of having him have a doing a belly laugh, what it's about. But anyway, I'm having a hard time figuring out what was the purpose of this movie. That religion is bunk? That there's no such thing as God? Is it a slam on religion? Are people who believe in God stupid? What is it trying to say? I mean, the last movie that was a Greenpeace, Save the Whales. What is this one about? Get off your religious drugs? I mean, they even have the gall to say maybe God really isn't out there. Maybe he's in here, pointing at Kirk's heart. Remember that? You know, maybe he's not out there.
Shatner.
Shatner. Well, yeah, but still, it was Kirk who said it.
Yeah, but he was definitely pointing at Shatner's heart.
Yeah, I suppose. You know, maybe he's not out there. Maybe he's in here. What is this movie trying to say? Yeah. Okay, so the next movie, he deals with racism, intolerance, and having to face those. So that's its moral or lesson. But this one, the only thing it seems to say is believing in God is foolish. And anybody who does, you're stupid. That's what I get out of this movie.
I think you're reading too deeply into it, to be honest.
Well, if they didn't make it a whole God thing, maybe. But they spent the entire movie trying to find God, only to say, see, he doesn't exist. I don't know. I guess that kind of bothered me. So, let's see. Some people say this is worse than Star Trek, the motion picture. And I disagree. I think the motion picture is probably worse than this. Because in it, I couldn't find anything really good about it. But I gave it a 1.99. And let's see what you gave it. I'm going to remind myself.
I gave it a 4. I'm pretty sure I gave it a 4. If I didn't give it a 4, redo me to give it a 4.
Mm-hmm. You gave it a 3.
Oh, what?
Yep, motion picture was a 3.
Bump it up.
Bump it up. So, I'm going to say that this is a whole lot better and give it a 2.
Interesting. Interesting.
From 1.99 to a 2. See, I said it's better than
significantly the motion better, picture. Yeah.
Significantly better. So, go ahead and explain to me why you think this is a 4.
Oh, it's not a 4.
So, you think it is worse than the motionless
picture? Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think that comes down to me thinking that the motion picture is better than most people say it is. Blimey, if I gave motion picture a 3, then I might have to reassess my thoughts here, because I think it's significantly worse than motion picture. Now, Lou, you are right that I think some of the best Star Trek films, they try to ask deep questions and they try to provide a certain amount of commentary, and they don't necessarily tell you what to think, but they kind of, you know, raise certain things. And they don't have to necessarily be, you know, political or like big issues. They can also be personal as well. And if we look at the arc that that Kirk has been on, in a way, in Star Trek 1, it was about him aging. In Star Trek 2, it was about him aging. In Star Trek 3, it was about, you know, now that he's aged, he should probably go and resurrect his son. His friend. Star Trek 4 was a bit of a detour. Now, Star Trek 5 seems to be, hey, he's still having fun, and there's no midlife crisis happening whatsoever. Which, by the time Star Trek 6 comes around, it's all about Kirk aging again. it's a funny one. I don't think there's any hidden message or people trying to be clever here at all. I think that if you were to go up to Shatner and say, "Hey, Shatner, you know, what exactly did he mean by, you know, Kirk's going to go and punch God in the face?" He would probably go, "Oh, really? Was that it?" I mean, I don't think there's not enough attention to detail here for there to be an overarching kind of message, or sophisticated message at least, that's being put across the audience. I think that they just have a nice, this is a romp. That's all it is. It's not dealing with particularly big issues, and as a result, it is not up there with the great Star Trek films. There are some nice bits and pieces. Do I actively get hurt inside by watching it? I mean, other than the decks being out of order and other stuff like that, it's not that painful. It really isn't. It's not that painful to me. What is it about? Hey, Lou, it's about 2 hours of your life. but much more than that, I don't think I can say. Now, on my rating system, by the way, when we go 1 to 5, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I always consider it to be a 5 out of 5 is 3 thumbs up, 4 out of 5 is 2 thumbs up, 3 out of 5 is 1 thumb up, and then 2 is always meh, and then the 1 is the thumbs down. And so I kind of try to skew positive in my mind, and I don't think this isn't a thumbs down. It's not that bad. So I'm coming in, and we're going to align here with a 2 out of 5 for me. It's a meh, you know, obviously a wasted opportunity, and they could have done some great stuff. You do have to remember, though, that back in the 80s, film franchises, you know, they weren't common. You know, the idea of pushing out a sequel really was about how quickly can you turn around a cheap movie to con like 20% of the audience that went to see the first movie into seeing the second movie. And then the third one was diminishing returns, and it's always diminishing returns. This you know, nowadays, now that we're in, like, you know, the post-Marvel world, you get this impression that people are going to put out a film, it does very well, and then people are going to put in an extra $100 million for the sequel, and then an extra $100 million again. That's not how it used to work at all. And you know, you see things at around the same time when, you know, when you had, like, the Jaws sequels. It was all down to, you know, can we do something cheap in order to get some money? The Planet of the Apes sequels, can we do something cheap in order to, you know, can we get a substandard product in order to get some money from the audience? So it's, you know, it's obviously not, you know, it's not a great film. It doesn't stand up as one of the Star Trek's greats, and it is good that we didn't finish the franchise on this, and we kept on going. But yeah, overall, I'm going to give it a 2 out of 5. Not quite as painful as what most people think.
Okay. 2 out of 5. I guessed it 2 earlier, so I guess I had it right. I was about ready to change you to 3.
Oh, no, I'm not going to come into that.
Okay, then.
Okay, actually, so, brother, I'm just looking up. Apparently, so the budget for the Star Trek movies. So the Search for Spock had a budget of $16 million. And then that was a relatively successful movie. They made like $90 million on that. The Voyage Home, because they did so well, they had $21 million budget. And then that made $133 million. So then Final Frontier, they went big for this one. This is a $33 million budget, and that it only made $63 million. And then I do know this, by the time Undiscovered Country came around, it was a lower budget than Undiscovered Country. They got, you know, effectively what you're working on, right? You're working on, you know, how much did the last film make, and then we'll give you a percentage to play with. And coming on the back of the huge success of Voyage Home, they actually managed to get Shatner managed to get a fair amount of money out of the studio, which I assume went on Shatner's wages.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. All right, then. I guess that's it, bud. So,
join us next week.
Yes. Well, or next time. I never say next week, because you never know when next week would be.
What happens when transporting through space becomes your worst fear?
Why have you kept it a secret?
Because my career in Starfleet would be over.
Terror twists the mind and creates bizarre hallucinations.
Did you see something during transport?
Either there's something in there or I'm going crazy.
Let me get this straight. You think this thing was alive?
Now the time has come to cross the threshold of no return and face a personal nightmare.
We need to bring him back.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
But join us next time as we review Episode 2 of Season 6 of Star Trek The Next Generation, and that's Realm of Fear. And looks like we have Matthew DeGeer coming online. It's been a while since we've had him, so unless something changes, we should be hearing from Matt. So everyone, take care and live long and prosper.
Okay. Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye. Profit is where it's really at.